This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Arroway. This happens to be the 300th episode of this podcast. Thank you, everyone. But thank you most of all. Okay, so actually in the first year, I think it was the first year of this podcast, I had a guest on to talk about her latest book, which was then In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite.
Oh my gosh.
2010, I think.
Wow.
Yeah. And now she's sitting here again, 6 years or so later.
And 300 episodes later.
She's the 300th episode lady of the day, the lovely, beautiful, and highly talented Melissa Clark.
Hello. Congratulations. 300 episodes.
Thank you.
That's
and welcome back.
Amazing. Great to be here.
You know what? I noticed that you have a bit of a milestone, too, because you've been a columnist for the New York Times doing your Good Appetite column since 2007. So now it's 10 years.
It is 10 years. And the funny Congrats. Thing is, it was 10. The 10th anniversary was a couple of weeks ago. And everybody missed it.
Even you?
Yeah, totally. I just wasn't even thinking. And then it occurred to me that it was 2017 and I started in 2007. And I should really look up the date of my first column. And it was like, you know, 10 days prior. Like, oh.
Well, congrats to you then.
Thank you.
Happy 10 years.
Thank
what
you.
Was your first column?
My first column was polenta with fried eggs and kale, which is still one of the most delicious dinners, right?
I mean,
it's like one of those pantry dinners, at least the polenta and the eggs.
Yeah.
And if you have anything green in your fridge, you just saute it up and there you have it.
I love doing that. I love how you say that polenta is sort of like a blank slate. And there's a very simple recipe in this book, Dinner, that has just polenta and some flash seared asparagus, I think, and a mound of burrata.
Oh, yeah.
That's the perfect dinner. Or it could be eggs or something, you know.
If I could possibly make burrata into dinner, then I'm just a happy person because it's just so good. You don't need, you don't need fancy anything. You just need burrata, which I guess is fancy.
There's a couple things with burrata in here, so maybe that's the next book. The burrata.
The burrata cookbook.
One ingredient, anything else goes.
Yeah, so I love it.
No, but this is a really great book. Dinner is the name of it. It's called Dinner, Changing the Game is the subtitle. It comes out in a couple weeks, so we're getting a nice, nice sneak peek. And, okay, so you write that you're changing the game because we tend to think of dinner as this, like, protein and two sides, right?
So right.
Mashed potatoes and peas and chicken or something.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's funny because I do feel like we've come so far as a society in so many ways. And also as diners, you know, we'll go out and we'll order whatever we want. I mean, we'll eat, you know, four sides and split an entree among four people, you know, and that'll be dinner. We're not afraid to mix it up. But when it comes to putting dinner on the table on a nightly basis, we still have a dinner problem. We get into a rut. So we either make the same dishes over and over again because we can do them fast and we know what to do. It's like, okay, you know, that chicken thing, I'm going to do that chicken thing because Or we think, okay, well, I'm going to make a protein and then here are my two sides.
Right.
And what I wanted to do in this book was to help people get out of their ruts by keeping the same techniques that everyone's comfortable with. So, you know, that chicken thing that you do, well, okay, here's that chicken thing, but maybe you wouldn't have thought to add roasted grapes with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not hard. There's nothing hard about it. It's not like a weird ingredient, but maybe you wouldn't
cool
have
idea.
Thought to make that connection, right? Or, for example, adding cumin when, you know, we think, okay, cumin is something that we're going to use with like Mexican cooking or Indian cooking. But what if I added it to, you know, your classic Italian sauteed greens? Just like little touches that are unexpected, that deliver a lot of flavor and that get you out of doing the same thing night after night.
And then it'll carry on with the sides, too. It's like, oh, if I'm going to add this, you know, preserved lemon to my roast chicken, then why don't I make a little... couscous or something in salad.
Yeah.
And then go from there.
Yeah, well, you're doing it. So the idea in this book is that every recipe in the book is meant to be dinner. Like, you don't need to make two or three things. You know, so if I have a recipe for, say, a roasted butternut squash, right? At the same time, I'm going to roast sausage so that it's all together.
I love this cover.
So it's like all together and you're doing it together. Or maybe there'll be a dish where, okay, you want to add a salad because there's not quite enough green in there for you, or you know, haven't had vegetables today. So you can add a salad. Plus I'm addicted to salad. I eat salad every single day. So to me, I always add a salad, but that's as far as you need to go. You don't need to make a separate side dish. So the meal is inclusive. And often you don't need
it's
to.
It's concise.
Yeah. And it's just, I think that especially after work, you know, we don't want to have to worry about making two or three things. We want to make one thing, but that one thing needs to be utterly delicious. It needs to be crave-worthy. It needs to feel satisfying.
Mm-hmm. And quite often that thing, well, you start out talking about roasting a whole chicken. So that is in actually six or seven different roast chicken recipes in here.
Well, because who doesn't love a roast chicken?
I totally agree with you, and I love doing it myself. However, I feel like that's one thing that a lot of people don't think of to do because, you know, it's a weeknight or something like that. And or getting a whole chicken is just intimidating in itself.
I think that's true. Actually, yeah. I think the roast chicken, you think of it as a Friday night thing or a weekend thing. Mm-hmm. It takes a while, too. I mean, to roast a chicken takes an hour. And maybe we don't want half an hour on a weekday, depending on what time we get home or if we're working from home and we forget, you know. Mm-hmm. So what I do is I'm very into chicken parts and flavoring them, you know, so you have, you know, parts that cook more quickly. And if I do have a roast chicken, I spatchcock it. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like that is one. So maybe that's
butterflying it.
Yeah, it's butterflying it. So that might be, you know, I say all the techniques in the book are really easy. And that
that's
true.
Fun too.
Except for butterflying. It's not that it's hard, but it's like people are like, oh, wait, what do I do? I have to take some scissors and cut the backbone of the chicken. The first time you do it, it's going to seem really weird.
Yeah.
And then it's so easy.
This poor bird.
I know.
And then you have to crunch the
breast down. Exactly. You have to take your hands and go crunch.
That's right? So satisfying.
Which actually is really satisfying. I'd love to do that. Get in there.
But then you have this whole bird, right? So afterwards you can make, you know, a salad with this crispy skin. I love taking the skin and crisping it up a bit and using pulled, you know, shredded leftover parts of the chicken. Yep. You can make a soup. You can make whatever.
Yeah. And you also, and then you have this amazing, you know, roast chicken dinner. And because you've spatchcocked the bird, it takes half an hour instead of an hour.
Now, other tips you had were to get a good bird. So what does that mean? You said air chilled.
Oh, yeah.
And also organic.
Oh, that whole thing. Yes.
Which one should we start with here?
So air chilled, when this is kind of gross, but I'm just going to go for it. When chickens are processed, they are often sprayed down with ice water or soaked in ice water after slaughter, they have to get cooled down as quickly as possible. That helps preserve them. And that's the reality of the protein that we're eating if we're eating chicken. I know. No, but I mean, you know, nobody wants to talk about chicken slaughter when we're talking about cooking. You know, we should all be informed about what we eat. Mm-hmm. So the bird is, and if you air chill it, it's a more expensive process, but you're not introducing water into the chicken skin, into the chicken meat. So you're getting a better flavor because it's like, think about it. You know, are you going to take your chicken
dilute it with water?
Right.
Like a sponge.
Exactly.
I think that, don't they also do that to sort of artificially plump up the weight?
Yes, exactly.
And sell it for like a
hundred. Right, yeah. Because if you've soaked your chicken, it's going to weigh a little more than air chilled. Yeah. But the skin is never going to be as crisp.
No.
You know, it's going to be soggy. I mean,
and not as tasty, too.
And not as tasty. You're going to have less flavor. So air chilled is your, if you can find that. Now, most... if you're going to get your chicken at the farmer's market or you're going to get it at a butcher, chances are it's been air chilled anyway.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's just what they do
generally. But you know, it's always good to ask. I always say, you know, talk to, you've got a butcher there. You've got an actual human as opposed to the supermarket where it's all in a case.
Yeah.
Strike up a conversation and try to find out stuff.
Right. Right. All right. So, and then also organic, you said it's a good way of sort of, you know, measuring how good the feed will be.
If you can get an organic bird, that's mm-hmm. great because you know it's been fed organic feed, which is mm-hmm. important. It also doesn't have any, you know, GMO in it. Mm-hmm. So that's another, if you're concerned about that, which, you know, mm-hmm. You can just not worry about that. But another thing about organic is that because, and this is not always the case, but it's generally it's going to be a better quality bird. So mm-hmm. not just from the feed, but generally it's going to be handled more carefully.
It
goes through more inspection. Yep. It's just going to be, so you're paying more, but you are getting a better product. And again, there, you know, this is like the general rule. Mm-hmm. But you know, you can also get great birds that aren't listed as anything because you're just buying them from a farmer and that's great.
And I always say when you get a whole bird, it's less expensive anyway than getting the cut up parts and deboned and what have you.
Oh yeah.
So that's a good reason to splurge a little bit on the extra quality.
The closer you get, the less processing has happened with your animal. Exactly. You know, it's going to be less expensive.
The closer to whole, exactly.
Same thing with your vegetables. You know, when you buy, if like you're buying those cut up squash chunks that have been skinned and seeded, they're going to be more expensive. I mean, however, you have to know that you're going to save time. So time is money. So you have to calculate what works best for you.
Mm-hmm. All right. So drying out the chicken, you have a few other tips. And I'm sorry, I love roasting chicken too, so it's really fun to get
about this. I love getting deep into the roast chicken.
So you advise to actually salt or season the chicken, and then if you can, leave it in the fridge uncovered overnight to dry it out even more, because, you know, getting rid of moisture will help crisp it up more. So
yes.
Yeah.
So think about this. So you're putting it in your fridge, and the fan is going in your fridge. So you have this, you know, environment that...
Air chilling.
You're kind of air chilling yourself. Yeah, so you're going to get a crispier skin.
I'll have to try that.
It also lets the seasonings go in, so you're going to get a much more flavorful bird.
Got it. I actually have this really old cookbook that advises to rub the chicken all over with lemon juice and let it sit for a couple hours or so first. And it worked out really well.
Yeah. You know, that again, it's going to add flavor and, you know, you can use, I would say add salt and lemon juice and then, you know, put it in your fridge and just let it kind of air dry a little bit.
Now, do you slather the whole thing with butter right before cooking?
I don't. I'm not a butter. I do a little olive oil. I mean, you know, I love butter. I'm happy to use butter, but it's just, I don't find that it needs it. You know, I mean, everything tastes good with butter. And if you want to put the butter under the skin and do that
A lot of people think that's how you need to get it crisp, but your way works. It looks beautiful. I can tell it's crispy and brown. So
I mean, a teeny bit of oil. Chicken skin is pretty fatty. Mm-hmm. And again, not that I'm against adding more fat to fat. I add fat to fat all the time. But I just don't think, I think with a chicken, you know, I'll use my butter on, I'll take all of that butter and put it right in those mashed potatoes.
Yeah. All right. So we covered chicken. Now, what came first, the egg? So you have a whole section on eggs, and people don't usually think of that for dinner.
That's so American of us. I mean, if you look at other cultures, eggs are usually dinner. They are often dinner, you know. In France, you don't get eggs.
There's no reason why not. There's absolutely no reason not to eat eggs other times of the day but breakfast.
And they're so quick, and they're so packed with protein, and they're so inexpensive. I mean, they're such a great... And I absolutely love them. But they're just a great, you know, resource
cheap,
that we don't use. Yeah.
Convenient protein. Yeah.
So I say eat more eggs. So I did a whole chapter on eggs. And they are, you know, you can make any of those recipes for breakfast, but please make them for dinner, because why shouldn't you take crispy fried eggs, right? I like fried eggs where you get crispy, you know, like the crispy, the edges of the whites turn crispy in your oil. So you get really hot oil. You fry up your eggs until they're crispy. I add sage to that oil so that the sage leaves get crisp.
That somehow makes it more dinnery.
Exactly. Although that would be great for brunch too, but right. Yeah. So it's like, and then I put Turkish pepper all over it, Aleppo or Turkish pepper all over the top. And I put scallions and then a little salted yogurt on that.
Nice.
I mean, it's so easy. It takes 10 minutes and it's so satisfying and delicious.
So subverting some paradigms here with dinner.
Changing the game.
And going on, you have no dessert section. However, there's this whole wonderful section on dips, spreads, and go-withs.
Yes, that's another thing. You know, when you get that really delicious... You know how you eat hummus for dinner sometimes? Like, it's just we all do. We sometimes just eat a container of hummus for dinner.
I've had good bread. Yeah, anything goes.
Exactly. Well, so why not just... sanction that. And mm-hmm. so I sanction that in this book. And it's not just hummus. I mean, I have a great hummus recipe, but I have all these different dips. It's funny because I was at, I had a little party and I had made one of the dips in there is this tuna dip. It's a can of tuna and it's like all these yummy things. And it's just so, it has basil in it. And it's delicious. And someone was eating this dip and they said, I could just eat this for dinner. I'm like, yes, that's the point. You could just eat that for dinner. That's the point. You have all your vegetables. You've got your amazing bread. You've got your whatever dip it is that you're really into. And you know what? That's dinner. That takes 10 minutes. And that is unexpected. It is full of flavor. It's healthy. It's exactly the way, at least I know that I want to eat, and I think a lot of people want to eat today.
That is how I want to eat, but I tend to snack like that while I'm making dinner so much that I'm enjoying it so much that by the time the dinner is cooked, I'm totally full
exactly.
and satisfied.
I used to do that too, and then I just realized, well, why not just make me snack my dinner?
Yep, good lesson learned.
Exactly, that way I can sit down and enjoy it with a glass of wine instead of standing up while I'm chopping Brussels sprouts.
Right, right. And you also have the infamous pea and guacamole dip, or pea guacamole, which received the ire of President Obama at the time.
Yeah, but he's, you know, I
peas
love,
and guacamole.
You know, he just, he... Okay,
I love
Obama. I love him so much, but he puts garlic in his guacamole.
Yeah, no, I was going to say.
So he don't know from
what
guacamole.
What?
No garlic in your guacamole.
So he tweeted back about this pea guacamole, saying, "No way, peas. It's got to be, you know, onions,
onion, garlic,
garlic.
I know,
cilantro,
yeah.
and tomato or something.
Yeah, which is just not. I'm sorry, that is wrong.
Thank you. I've never heard of." That just sounds overboard.
Yeah,
it's fresh garlic.
I don't want that in my guacamole. I mean, I love fresh garlic everywhere, but not my guacamole. And you know, I stand by that recipe. It's a great variation. There's nothing wrong with having lots of different kinds of guacamoles in the world. Pea guacamole is just, you know.
I love how it blends in there too.
It's so pretty.
Sweetness.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk a lot more about dinner after a quick little commercial break.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
All right, we're back chatting with Melissa Clark, author of the new Dinner Changing the Game cookbook, coming up in 2 weeks, March 7th. However, you may have noticed last week there was an amazing feature in the New York Times that Melissa wrote and produced and recipe tested for, and it was all about French cuisine, and hopefully you noticed it, because it was very... it was very irresistible looking, and I wanted to cook French after that. What was that all about?
I feel like people have forgotten how amazing French food is. You know, we're very busy discovering the rest of the world, which we should be, because there's a lot of fantastic ways to eat.
Oh, there's, you know, Moroccan food.
Exactly. But there's also, you know, French cuisine is one of the building blocks of European culture, you know, and that's big. That's huge. I mean, it is, you know, Europe. It's not the world, but it's still a giant place with great food.
And food appreciation.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it was also one of what's interesting about French food. It was also one of the first national cuisines to kind of coalesce. You know, I mean, like, we know how regional Italian food is. You know, but if you think, but French food was codified and it became a thing. It became a unified thing way earlier than a lot of other places in the world. So in Europe, especially. And it was also talk about a game changer. It really changed. French food really, French cuisine really changed the way people thought about cooking, which was fascinating to me when I was doing the research for this project. What I learned was up until through the Middle Ages, all of Europe, when they were European cooking was about health. It was primarily about health.
Tonics and whatnot.
Exactly. And well, just in the way you'd combine ingredients was to, it was based on a very ancient, you know, even I think going back to the Greeks, way of thinking about health through food. So food, it was the humor system. Mm-hmm. And so you had your four humors in your body and you had to balance them. And that was how you were going to be healthy. And food was a way to do that. It's fascinating, right? I mean, this is stuff we don't think about. And what happened in France was that there was a shift away from cooking with a lot of spices, with a lot of putting spices and aromatics together in order to give health, you know, so pork was considered moist and cold, so you needed to add warming spices in order to balance it out so that you wouldn't, you know, get a cold if you ate it. And what happened in France was things shifted to, you know what, let's actually talk about how to make this delicious ingredient, these peas. How do we make these peas taste really good and not worry about if they're going, you know, what their physical attributes are, just let's eat them with butter.
Ah, gotcha.
And that was revolutionary.
It doesn't taste good. Yeah.
Yeah. And herbs was different too. I mean, using herbs instead of spices, you know, and it was really this seismic shift that we don't even think about.
Thanks to France.
So that was, you know, so at least certainly, like I said, at least in the context of Europe, that was a really important moment. And I loved, researching
That's really cool.
What we decided at the time is the reason we decided to do this is to tell the story of French cooking through 10 iconic dishes. And so we have quiche, and we have coq au vin, and we have bœuf bourguignon, and we have cassoulet, and omelets.
Sole meunier.
Exactly, yeah. And souffle. And I went deep into each recipe. I really wanted to not just tell the history of the recipe and the context of the recipe, but really walk people through the steps. And
so
why do you
cool.
do this? You know, why this technique here? And get it to a point where people could not help but make something absolutely delicious.
And get a whole cohesive sort of story. You don't have to make everything, but, you know, this is something you can stew on over.
Yeah, you go in and you make one delicious quiche. So, for example, the quiche chapter is about onion quiches, but it's also about onions. How do you use onions to the best way? You know, how do you get different characters out of onions? And then I have a recipe for a piece of lardière, which is another interpretation of an onion tart in southern France.
Uh-huh.
And I have a tart flambé, which is another onion tart from northern France. And how do
That's
all
so
of these
smart.
Connect?
Yeah.
So people can still go, you know, you can go click on the new essentials of French cooking on the NYT cooking site, and there are recipes there for you. There's video.
Love it.
It was a lot of fun.
You do everything. So, you know, you have video up there. You've got tons of digital recipes. And it seems like this new project is sort of like having like a book that opens up into another book and then another book which you can explore and take in so many different directions.
Yeah, well, you know,
cool.
People who read my column, you know, it's all there. It's all online.
You have so much content out
but,
there, yeah.
But then this book is like, it's an object. You could pick it. I mean, for me, I think I still love cooking from cookbooks, and I hope people do too. And another thing about this book, okay, so it doesn't come out for 2 weeks, but if you pre-order it now from your favorite you know, wherever you buy books, you will get a special pre-order recipe booklet, which is cool. So you get like an extra 5
That's
recipes.
Really cool.
And one of them is a really easy, delicious apple cake dessert. So go do that.
Pre-order a dinner, changing the game, and then you have an extra
You get an extra little
appetizer.
A little present. Exactly. Because there are no appetizers in that. It's all dinner. So if you want the appetizer, you have to get the booklet.
Well, some could go, you know.
Some could
be.
Yes, the dips. Okay. You could totally do that.
Yeah.
If you wanted to.
I love that. So it's so cool because, like, I have a lot of cookbooks, and I find that I'm always opening and then referring to another one and then splaying it open. So you could do so much with digital. Are you going to do more projects like the Essentials of French Cooking?
Oh, at the Times?
Yeah.
Yeah, we are, but we're all just like, I mean, it was so much work.
That was, you're right.
People keep asking, like, what are you going to do next? I don't know.
What do you call it? This whole medium of like a,
yeah,
I don't know.
It's a whole other,
it's weird.
We call it a premium guide.
That premium is our guide.
Premium
okay.
guide. So it's a guide, because it's a
okay.
guide of
right,
French
right.
cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
We do a lot of guides at the Times at NYT Cooking.
Sure.
I mean, NYT Cooking is an amazing resource because it's not just recipes. We have these guides. So there's I wrote an ultimate roast chicken guide. everything you want to know about roasting a chicken. And that's there, too. You know, there's a lot of stuff. So if you go into that world, you'll be able to find not just recipes, but added
really
content.
Fun. What do you like doing best? Cookbooks? I don't know. Video?
You know, I love... I love all of it. Yeah. The video is interesting. It's definitely the most challenging for me.
Yeah.
It's the hardest, which is good because I feel like stretching oneself is important.
Good, good.
But it's hard.
No, it looks like a lot of fun, though. It's very, I don't know, homey.
Yeah, we keep it homey. We keep it real because we're in my home.
Yeah.
So
got- yeah. Oh, speaking of which, I had an interesting conversation. A friend of mine said she cooks dinner. And whenever she and her boyfriend cook dinner, they usually end up eating standing up in the kitchen.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. And I realized let's talk about the mechanics of dinner for a second.
Yeah.
Because weirdly enough, I have a real table, but I end up sitting at the coffee table. That's just where I like to have dinner. And like, I'll put a pillow on the floor and I'll kneel like Japanese style.
You know, I think people should find their dinner bliss wherever it is in their house.
Right.
If it's better to stand at the counter or better to kneel at the coffee table, awesome. That's great. I mean, you're eating dinner that you've cooked. I just think that's the most important thing.
I think that is important because I hear, you know, a lot of gripes and hang-ups that people have about cooking at home. And, you know, number one is my kitchen's not good enough or it's too small, especially in the city here.
Right.
But number two is, like, I don't have really the setup to enjoy a proper dinner at home, like my desk doubles as a table.
Yes.
So how can you kind of dinner up your home setting?
Well, you know, one thing, I mean, it's the same thing, you know, our house, our dining table is, you know, Dolly does her home, my daughter does her homework there, and I do my work there. And it's very much the table. It is the table, exactly. So we don't even try to clear it all off because it's like there's so much stuff on it.
Okay.
So we don't even try to clear it all off. We just, you know, while I'm cooking, my husband is just like clearing a little path in that table.
Yeah.
And you know what we do every night? We light the candles. We light the candles. It's like, okay, that signifies.
That signifies. That,
so it's even if we're sitting at the same place where 5 minutes ago I was actually working and Dahlia was doing homework or coloring or whatever. Now it is dinner time. And I mean, lighting the candles my husband put all of our lights on dimmers. So we dim the lights ever so slightly.
Yeah.
We light the candles. I love cloth napkins and I do think they're more ecological. So we have our cloth. So we have like a few things that are like, you know, this is a special time, but I do feel like that's our ritual. Everyone should develop their own rituals. Like what is the thing that makes you feel like you're taking care of yourself?
Right.
Cause I think cooking for yourself is the ultimate way to take care of yourself and then create a space to enjoy it, whatever that means to you.
Buy a dinner bell. How
yes,
about that?
Yes, exactly. Put on your special dinner music.
Or get really full eating all the snacks that you ate while cooking dinner.
You know, when I did that, so that was like, I would, because, you know, if I'm developing recipes all day, I'm not starving by dinner time, but I still sit down and have a salad and a glass of wine with my husband, and then he eats whatever I've cooked all day long.
Ah.
And it's still like that
rituals,
time and that connection, you know.
Rituals. I love it. Is that why you decided to cook this book? To do this book is to kind of just relish the dinner, like the sort of meal that we all kind of look forward to the most and
stress about. I mean, dinner is cooking dinner is my favorite time of the day. Like I write in the introduction that when I'm making dinner and I'm drinking a glass of wine, usually while I'm cooking, and my husband and my daughter, like we're all hanging out in the kitchen, talking and listening to music, and it's like my daily equivalent of the weekend. That is when I de-stress. That is my, like, okay, the work day is over. Even if I'm going to work after dinner, I pretend I'm not. You know? But it is my chill time, my best time.
It's your hygge.
It's my hygge. I love it. So I want everybody to, you know, if I can get people to cook a little more and be a little kinder to themselves at that end of the day, I think that's awesome.
I can't agree with you more. Flipping through this book too, and every recipe, I'm like, I agree. I want this. I want to cook this. I love it. So definitely, there's so many. There's so many. How many recipes?
220.
Yeah, that's a lot.
225 maybe.
So get this book and be well fed for a lifetime, as the old saying goes. Thank you. It looks like that's about all the time we have, but thank you.
That just flew by. It was great to talk to you.
Thanks so much, Melissa, and congratulations.
Thank you. And congratulations to you, 300th
episode. Thank you. Couldn't have been better. All right. Well, thanks, everyone at Heritage, too. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Oh, I like the way you do.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.